You're listening to a special Stumptown trade review. We're sitting down tonight with Jamie Rich, talking about his new book, Spellcheckers. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Am I your first repeat offender?
I think you really are. Well, no, wait. We actually had David Mack. We caught up with David Mack at Emerald City and Jim Rugg. So you're our three-peat. How's that?
That's fine. I can deal with that. That's good company. I can take it.
So we're talking tonight about Spellcheckers. Give us a brief overview of the book. What can a reader expect?
Basically, I mean, the upfront pitch was it's Mean Girls meets The Craft. It's really just like I love high school comedies, and particularly growing up in the 80s with John Hughes and Heathers. And I love Mean Girls. I love those kinds of movies. I wanted to do that, and at the same time, I, for whatever reason, decided to marry it to the teen witch genre. So it's really just an over-the-top, rude comedy set in high school and features three girls who got a hold of a magical spell book and ever since have ruled their high school with a magic fist. And instead of like doing good or anything like that, they sort of what kind of spells would teenage girls do? Well, cover my homework, make it so I don't have to go to gym class, that kind of thing. So it's, yeah, a lot of insult comedy, a lot of one-liners, and then sort of parodies of magic stories.
So why did you choose to go for sort of the teen bitch as opposed to the teen witch angle with this?
Part of it came out of, the whole thing started, Joelle had done this sketch of three girls she had seen in a bar, and it was a really stylized sketch that I think we both really liked. And this is where we differ and refuse to agree. I believe she said you should create a story out of these three, and I said okay. And she says that I was like, I'm going to take this and create a story with it. I think I'm right, because I think history will show, and she knows that I have a better track record from remembering stuff when we've been drinking, which is how this happened.
Let the record state that Joelle is not here to defend herself or hit him, so.
Which she would do both. But I think there's worse things you can have in a creative relationship that like you're not fighting over, no, I can't with this idea. It's like, no, you did this. I think that's the better way to have it. And I just would sort of start tossing it around in my head. And literally what kind of came up was the first scene in the book, where it's the three girls doing the little magic spell with their dolls, because they all have totems that are their dolls. And it kind of just snowballed. And I wrote what became the first chapter, I think people are going to hate me for this, but I think in a day. No other writers get mad. Joelle gets mad that I can do it so fast. But it just kind of happened. And it was a pitch for Ben Abernathy at Wildstorm. And unfortunately, he liked it a lot, but the timing was bad and for him. And so it just kind of blew out of that, and I'd only written that when we went to Oni and we had found Nicholas Hattori Day, our artist, and sort of that was all I had, and suddenly I had to come up with the rest of the story.
So, you know, you strike a really delicate balance here, because the characters, like you said, I mean, they're ruling the school, they're making this for their own benefit, basically. They're not necessarily the most likable characters. So how did you go about striking the balance for writing characters who could have this sort of mean girl's edge, but yet we as the readers would actually want to read about and cheer for?
I mean, I think what it comes down to is that they're funny. And when you watch Heathers or you watch Mean Girls, you do like watching those other girls. And so I think by removing the Winona Ryder or the Lindsay Lohan character, and which ends up being the conscience of the movies, of the stories, you kind of neutralize this. You don't have a character that you're into that they offend. So they do treat some people badly in the book, but you're not connected to them. So I think then you just go along for the ride. At least that was my hope. Is like, why come up with a super hug at the end and somebody who has to learn from this experience, why not just stick with these girls? And particularly for the first book too, I wanted to just like go all out and have them be who they are. And I think we're definitely planning to do three books, and I think so the second one you kind of get a little more about their backgrounds and how, and sort of the secrets that they might have. My feeling is that they all have a little bit of, like, they're teenagers, so the guise they project is partially true and partially masking certain elements of themselves. And I think that as the books progress, you'll get a little more of that. They'll never, it's South Park. It's, you know, at the end, in fact, the first editor who looked at it did say, well, you know, these girls are awful. Like, are they going to learn anything? And it's like, we could, but if we do that, I want to do it like South Park, where here's what we learned today. And then someone goes, nah, and you walk on.
Well, and you know, before we got to recording, you were talking about how this book has actually courted a little bit of controversy with, like, librarians because, I mean, in addition to the language, there is kind of a lack of a moral message for this.
Yeah, I mean, it's always, there's a divide between what teenagers and particularly and even kids like and what their parents think they should see. And so a lot of librarians have gotten into it and identify that of, like, kids will really, really like this. And I've always maintained too, when people wanted to talk about, well, is this too extreme for young adult, I was like, well, look at the Gossip Girl books. Those are pretty out there. All of the what gets popular is pretty out there, and you can get away with a lot because teenagers want you to speak honestly to them, and they can tell if you are faking it or you're trying to deliver them some coded message. They're much smarter than we give them credits for. And I also think you can't get beyond that audience if you don't do that. Like Clueless is one of my favorites. And that has a lot of really sort of randy double entendres. And yet nobody I've ever heard of objecting to teenagers seeing Clueless. So that was another one I always thought of like, I wanted that level of dialogue. And so I think this came up too, and when the Where the Wild Things Are movie came out, and some of the critics, in defense of how scary it was, remembers that when you're a kid, there's a certain element of you that is into the mysterious and the dangerous and the things you don't understand, and they make you want to know more. And while this is a comedy, I think that the same kind of rules apply, that what is funny and interesting about it might be what's a little beyond the normal line.
So who is your intended audience for this book?
I really, like, wanted to cast the net wide. I mean, we keep mentioning Mean Girls, and I think that was a movie that everybody went to see, regardless of age. Superbad is like that. It's one that, you know, if I was in high school, I would have loved Superbad if it had come out then. But at the same time, I saw it in my 30s and thought it was hilarious. So I think that's really, like, I think age doesn't end up mattering if you're true to that age group. I think overall, particularly if it's older audiences looking back, you can remember what that was like. And so I think you can hit, if as long as you're true to what you're telling, I think you can hit any level.
So then do I dare ask where you found your inner 16-year-old girl to write the voices for this?
I've always been somewhat of an inner 16-year-old girl. I've had my apartment described as looking like a high schooler's bedroom before, because I got, like, posters on the wall, and I've got more. I mean, I didn't have to go find my Taylor Swift music to listen to while writing this. I already had it. There's an element of me that's always sort of been into that stuff, and I've always been actually a guy that was more friends with girls than I was with men and with boys. So part of it too is I sometimes have described the book as for people who were Blue Monday fans and remembered the letters columns where China Clugston and I would sit there and insult each other and the readers. And in a way, that was how I wrote this book, was like, well, just imagine I'm insulting China Clugston, which is supremely easy. You'd be surprised.
So it's a pretty well-known fact that you're a music fan, and you mentioned your extensive Taylor Swift collection here. So what musical influences and references did you work into the book?
Lily Allen was also the major thing I listened to. The chapter titles come from Morrissey, Franz Ferdinand, Nas, and Lily Allen. So it's kind of across the board. There's not a ton in there. There's a few songs that show up at the party, as I was talking earlier. I went looking for, like, some of the more ridiculous songs. So like Lil Wayne's Lollipop ends up, it's because the lyrics are so outlandish that I had to use it. But otherwise, yeah, music wasn't that huge. It was more of what I would listen to, stuff that was kind of upbeat to keep me in the mood.
So let's jump over to the artistic collaboration, because you're working with your regular collaborator, Joelle Jones, but you also have Nico Hattori Day, who has joined you on this. How did that artistic collaboration work?
For a while, Spellcheckers was like a back burner idea. We had had it sitting around, and we had Joelle's sketch, and that was all that was in the pitch. And I think I mentioned I tended to pitch it to Wildstorm. And so when that was kind of I want to get in some place where I could maybe get like a mainstream level paycheck for us. Because I was basically trying to find ways for Joelle and I to make more money, because this would probably been between 12 Reasons and You Have Killed Me, so before she particularly started getting a lot more offers. So when it was done, it was kind of a lark. So it was easy to sort of push to the side, and I kept saying, well, I'm running these other things for you, Joelle, so let's not worry about it. And then one day on MySpace, of all things, Nico contacts me based on a review I had done of a 1980s concert by Johnny Hallyday, who was like the French Elvis in the 60s. So this was like well past his prime. And he just was like, how does the guy from Only Press know who the hell Johnny Hallyday is? And so we started corresponding, but before I had written him back even, I did my duty and sort of followed his profile to see who he was, and followed his links and saw his art portfolio, and just about lost my mind and really couldn't believe nobody had had him doing anything yet. And so it was quickly after that where I was basically like, hey, you have this book. You want to do some sketches? And as he says, and he wrote his own bio for the book, and the last line of his bio is like, I've now realized my dream of working for Oni Press. So it was really easy to convince him, like, we can do this. And
so now his style is vastly different from Joelle's. Was that part of the appeal for you then?
Not necessarily. Yeah, the plan had, because I had talked to a couple other artists before that, and the plan had always been that Joelle would stick around, and actually we thought she'd probably do more of an art direction job than she had done, and that she would do the flashbacks was always the plan, which was based on an old Oni series called Hopeless Savages, where the flashbacks were always drawn by different artists. And so I was always just kind of looking for a complementary style, which I feel that in some ways, even though he's way cartoonier, Nico still is kind of within the same similar school in some of their influences. He's more way more manga than she is, but their European influence crosses over. Particularly, he was a student at a school, at the Disney school in Italy, that was, hopefully I don't destroy their names, but Barbara Canapé and Alessandro Barbucci, who created Witch and Monster Allergy, and most importantly Sky Doll, had created. And Joelle and I are big Sky Doll fans, and so I think in that realm they cross over.
So, and you were talking before about some of the challenges that you faced with this kind of collaboration, because his first, you know, language is not English. So how does it work, you know, crossing not just, you know, major oceans, but also working with someone whose language is not English, and getting your, you know, script or your artistic idea across to him?
One of the lucky things we had is that he and I actually have a very compatible taste as far as movies and music. And so we were able to trade a lot of those influences. So if we hit a hiccup where he specifically had a problem, I could find the right visual reference to say, well, it's like this. And so where our language would break down, since it's comics, visuals would work out well. There's a reference in the book to the Peach Girl comics and wanting to get something like they do in there, which I won't go into because it's actually in the end of the book, so it's a spoiler. But I was just able to go, like, this is kind of what I'm talking about, and he instantly moved from that. And so that helped us out. It's been interesting comparing notes between the American comic industry and the French comic book industry, like particularly like explaining to him how cons work here and how he was shocked when I booked my own table for Chicago or for Stumptown in my own hotel room. And he was, but at the same time, he was shocked also that you weren't expected to show up and sit there and draw for 8 hours for everybody who came up and trying to explain to him, no, you can sell your sketches and make some money. And so it's been fascinating. And the first book had some learning experiences, but I think we're kind of gotten that ironed out now.
So how is your pacing as a writer differed based on the artist you're working with, but also the kind of story that you're crafting? Because this is, you know, a very different story from your previous release, You Have Killed Me. So how is your pacing working differently for this?
I think in both cases, well, I think it moves faster than and You Have Killed Me, and there's a lot less that needs to be explained. You just sort of run with it because it's so much more dialogue driven than plot driven. And so I think a lot of the times the conversation's dictated. And so when I was scared of writing comedy the same way I was scared of writing noir, and now I maybe need to get over myself and just accept that, just do it when it comes down the pack. But it's always finding your way into something new, and comedy is hard because people think I'm funny, but if you ask me to be funny, it's fail. Because as soon as it's like, I have the same problem with dancing. I can dance, and I will say it, I can dance. But if I have to stop and think about dancing, I can't learn steps. I can't follow a pattern, because the moment I think about it, it falls apart. And I feel comedy is the same way. Like, if I am just rolling with it, I can be funny, but if I have to try, it's just going to be pathetic. And there have been many online exchanges that I think have proven that, where I just throw out a clunker and just like, ugh. So for me, once I got into the writing, it was coming down to the girls and their conversations. And so once I'd get rolling with how they talked and the insults flying back and forth, that pushed the story farther and farther along. And so I think that's how I ended up working out a lot of the pacing. Nico probably changed more of my pacing than a lot of the other stuff I've worked on so far. But for the most part, it's worked out, so I can't complain too much.
So how did you strike a balance between the humor, you know, being, you know, nerdy or current or pop reference, and then, you know, trying to rein yourself in so it wasn't just, you know, a gag a minute type book?
Yeah, I mean, I was prepared to rewrite any line that had a prop reference. I somehow was a little bit, enough of my teenage girl was ahead, because I figured out like Lady Gaga and Selena Gomez jokes would be perfect for right now. So I think both have gotten more popular since I wrote the script. That kind of stuff I was prepared to reevaluate when it came down to it, to say, well, you know, these people might be over. And I just kind of let most of that happen naturally. And when the joke called for it, put it in there. And because my theory is basically like, if you can be current when it comes out, you're going to be okay. But if you're not current when it comes out, if you're behind the times, and people will think that you're behind the times. But once it's out, if the references lose their currency, people are more forgiving of it, because it's sort of now ensconced itself into your pop culture. And so if you think back to like movies in the 80s and even the 90s or before that, like all these comedies that refer to stuff that you might not know what they are, you've sort of let it go.
So you talked a little bit about the 3-book deal, that this is, you know, this is the first, hopefully, of 3 books. What can we look forward to from the other 2 books? What's sort of your master plan, if you will?
Right now, the idea was to keep it within the first year. So it's like their sophomore year in high school, and that the books themselves would cover that year, which would give us a lot more room if we wanted to do more. So that was the main thing right there, was to sort of figure out, well, what can be complete within themselves in case that's the only things we do, but then not put down the wall. Because they're so fun to write that it could be very easy to keep going. So the second book will start off during their winter break and lead into the beginning of the second semester of the school year, whereas the third book currently is planned to be probably prom. And if we do a fourth, I don't know if I would do summer vacation and go away from the school for a while would be a possibility. But that's the basic plan, and things will grow, and you'll get to know more about their past and who they were, and you'll get characters that will keep coming back in new situations. You know, there's a character in the first book who plays a major role that sticks around, and so each time I think as we put new situations in, we're gonna find more levels to everybody. And while the girls probably won't change too drastically, we will figure out that there's a little more to them than so that you can keep liking them and not just want to kill them.
All right. Well, something to look forward to. So once again, this is Spellcheckers coming out from Oni Press, available now in finer local comic book shops or at the convention near you. Thanks a lot for sitting down with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.